You know, and I think it's very important for people to understand that the Greek audiences, when they went to this play, already knew the story.
And I think with our students, they miss a lot of the references in character speeches and in the choral speeches. They hear what characters or the chorus is saying, but they don't understand the same depth of understanding as an audience would at that day and time who are watching a performance of Aeschylus's trilogy, because they only hear it briefly and they don't see that there's like a wealth of information being
given
right
going
there.
Back to the house of Atreus, and even before that, the great-grandfather Tantalus. Can you tell us that story?
Well, according to the legend, Tantalus was favored by the gods. Some say he was a son of Zeus himself, but he was often invited to Mount Olympus and would dine with the gods. Some say that he stole some of the ambrosia of the gods and shared it with other human beings, and anyway, made the gods angry. But the point that's relevant to our trilogy is the fact that Tantalus, for some unexplained reason, though some people think that he was testing the omniscience of the gods, he'd invited the gods to his home for a banquet and inexplicably decided to sacrifice his son, Pelops, chop him up, cook him up, and serve him to the gods.
That sounds a little brutal, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the gods, of course, were not too happy about the fact that they were being asked to dine on human flesh. But, you know, this kind of goes along with this idea that maybe he was testing the omniscient power of the gods, because surely then they would know and would not eat. Supposedly, according to this legend, though, the only divinity who actually did consume a part of Pelops before it was realized by everyone what was going on was the goddess Demeter. Apparently, some sources say she was distracted because of worries over her daughter, and so she ate without thinking, but the other gods immediately knew something was wrong and did not share in this abhorrent feast. And so what happens is that they're very angry with Tantalus and decide to punish him for eternity. If he had indeed, you see, eaten the ambrosia of the gods, then he too would be immortal and they couldn't kill him. But what they could do is make his eternal life one that he wished he never had to live. So they made a special place. According to Homer in the Odyssey, there's a place in the underworld where Tantalus is surrounded by clear, cool water that comes almost up to his lips, and he gets so thirsty and he wants to assuage his thirst, and he can't because the water will recede when he makes a move toward it. And there's all these branches of delicious fruit just dangling right in front of his eyes, and as soon as he tries to take one taste, they swing out of the way. So this is where supposedly we get our modern word tantalize, by the fact that he could never assuage his hunger or thirst, which is appropriate, don't you think? I mean, if you sin against the gods by trying to give them some banquet of abhorrent food, then their punishment for eternity is that you can never stage your thirst or your hunger. You'll never be able to banquet on good things to eat, much less anything.
Well, it's poetic justice,
it is
at the very least.
At least. But according to the myth, then Tantalus' son has been cooked. So what do we do? I mean, how does Tantalus's family line continue? Well, supposedly, these being gods, they could take care of that matter pretty quickly. So they decide to put the pieces back. Of course, they were missing this one shoulder bone because of Demeter. But they put the pieces of poor Pelops back in the pot, and they re-stewed him up, and the gods put their magic into the pot, and they brought him back to life. They had to manufacture, however, that shoulder bone out of ivory, because they didn't have the original anymore. And then here we have Pelops, who was brought back to life by the gods. And in fact, one of the gods, Poseidon, favored him. Some say he loved him and made him his cupbearer and brought him up to Olympus, similar to the story of Ganymede being the cupbearer of Zeus. And things went along for a while, but Zeus wasn't too happy about the fact that Pelops was up there on Mount Olympus, and so decided that a more appropriate place for him to be would be back on Earth. And so he's more or less kicked out of paradise, if you will, or Mount Olympus, and brought back down to Earth. And once he was back down at Earth, he decided that he wanted to marry a young lady named Hippodameia, whose father was not too eager to marry her off, actually. So according to stories about this, the father, some say, had a kind of a unnatural affection for his daughter and didn't want to let her go, didn't really want her to marry anybody else. So he set up a contest for her hand, and all of her suitors had to come to his country and enter a chariot race. The problem is her father had a formidable chariot team of horses and was apparently not easily defeated. So he knew the cards were stacked in his favor. So he would say to the suitors, well, if you want the hand of my daughter in marriage, you have to race me in a chariot race. And if you win, you get her hand. And if you lose, I kill you. And apparently that had gone on for some time.
She must have been awfully beautiful.
So apparently at least a dozen of the suitors were slain in such a fashion. And here's Pelops with his family of history of not being the most marriageable person around, who decides he wants her. So he goes to her country, and in fact, some versions of the legend say that Poseidon wanted to help him out and gave him this magical set of horses, but not maybe trusting enough in the gods' favor, he decides that he's going to try to have an extra edge even beyond that. So supposedly he falls in love with Hippodamea and she with him, and they're trying to come together and figure out a way that he can actually win this chariot race. Some versions say it was she who came up with the plot. Others don't mention that at all. But apparently he or she approached her father's charioteer, a man named Myrtilus, and made a deal with him that if he would help them rig this race so that Pelops would win, that he would be amply rewarded. Now, some of the versions that say that Pelops is the one that made the deal with Myrtilus claim that he had offered Myrtilus not only wealth, for example, but also that he had offered him possibly part of the wedding night with his new bride. But he had no intentions, apparently, of keeping his word on that matter. So Myrtilus...
Did she?
Well, actually, no. Apparently, what happens is that Myrtilus took the linchpins out of the wheels of the chariot of the king and replaced them with wax linchpins. So when the race was going on fast and furious, the friction on the wheels caused the wax linchpins to melt. And so the wheels just spin away, and the king's chariot is falling apart beneath him, and so he is dragged to his death with the horses from his famous chariot. So he dies, which, of course, makes Pelops
The
win
winner.
The race.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would
and
say so.
Then, of course, he and Hippodamea hopefully can marry and live happily ever after, and he can rule her father's kingdom as well. But there's the problem with Myrtilus. He made a deal with Myrtilus to betray the king in such a fashion. And apparently, some versions say that Myrtilus was in love with Hippodamea also. And so he was quite eager to see if he could get that share of the reward that had to do with her person, but that when he made some moves on her, that she complained to Pelops, and Pelops killed him. Supposedly he either threw him off a cliff, some versions say, or they were in a boat, and he threw him into the sea. So part of the curse on the family of what became known as the House of Atreus goes back to their founder, Tantalus, who somehow is this madman who wants to take on the gods. So they have, like, bad blood, shall we say, running through their veins from the beginning. But on the other hand, some people say that the king, when his chariot comes apart and he realizes he'd been betrayed, that he put a curse on the family of Pelops. But then when Myrtilus is betrayed by his co-conspirator here and is killed, supposedly when he goes down, he curses Pelops and his family, so we have, like, multiple layers of curses. But in this case, there's plenty of sin to go around, because and lots of betrayal to go around, as you'll notice. Tantalus betraying his father Zeus or the other gods. Then you have Pelops betraying his co-conspirator to get the woman of his dreams.
What about his kids?
Well, that's where the next generation starts having problems. Pelops and Hippodamea marry and produce several children, two of whom are supposedly twin sons, Atreus and Thyestes. And that generation definitely did not get along. Talk about dysfunctional.
Sounds like a dysfunctional family situation, to say the least.
From the beginning, right.
If not a soap opera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With father and son, and then here with brothers. Because, for one thing, you have two young men who are ambitious. If they're twins, it's like, who's actually going to rule? That's one issue, okay, over the kingdom of Mycenae, though Aeschylus in his play says it's the kingdom of Argos. But here's two brothers, twins. The two of them are married. They have offspring. But supposedly there's this issue over a woman again. So that's kind of a repetitive thing that begins to happen. You have two men wanting the same woman and coming to violence over it. In this case, it's two brothers. Supposedly, Thyestes covets his brother, Atreus' wife. Her name was Aerope, and supposedly, some versions say she returned that love and she betrayed her husband with his brother. And that part of it had to do with the throne. Atreus says to him, well, if you want to come back and make it up to me, then okay, we'll sit down, we'll talk about it. And why don't you come for a visit? I'll entertain you at a banquet. So we have this hospitality issue raised.
So there's a sort of promise of reconciliation.
Exactly. And all would be laid to rest, all of the grievances.
So here comes Thyestes to the banquet,
thinking that he's getting back into Atreus' good graces. But what Atreus has done is to capture Thyestes' sons, kill them, or have them killed and have them chopped up and cooked. And so his brother is served these delicacies at the banquet. And again, kind of like Demeter at that other banquet, he doesn't suspect that what he's eating is the flesh of his own children.
So does what? Child sacrifice run in the genes?
So
or
it
what?
Seems to. It seems
cannibalism, child
so
killing, unfaithful women.
Yeah, and we're going back, see, to taking a page out of grandfather Tantalus's book of crime to chop up innocent children who did nothing to Atreus, but Atreus is using their deaths to avenge himself on his brothers for supposedly this unfaithful wife. So yeah, unfaithful wives running this family, and bad blood, and I mean literally bad blood, and sharing of blood, and consuming of the flesh of
children. Well, not to mention the lack of hospitality
here. There you go. Because it's starting with Tantalus. You know, he breaks the sacred law of hospitality by being protected by Zeus himself by inviting Zeus and the other guys to a banquet and then treating them in that fashion, trying to get them to eat something that is just, that's really sacrilegious if you stop to think about it. And now we have this generation where a brother, in order to get, I guess he didn't want to kill Thyestes, he wanted Thyestes to live a long life in horror, knowing that he had consumed the flesh of his children.
But isn't there one survivor? I mean, isn't
there is
Aegisthus?
There is. Or the story would have ended here. But
Aegisthus later grows up and becomes Clytemnestra's.
That's
lover,
right.
While
according to Aeschylus' version of things, Aegisthus was a mere babe in arms, and so like in the care of a nursemaid. And so when the older children were captured and by the soldiers of Atreus and brought to the palace and killed and cooked, there is this one male child, Aegisthus, who survives. So apparently there's this one infant child who's remaining, and his father, of course, being told after he ate what he had eaten and knowing that his brother had finally got him and got him good for any bad deeds that he had done to Atreus, went mad, they say. So madness is another kind of recurring thing. You know, he went mad for a time.
You mean they weren't already mad?
Well, that's debatable, yeah. Too. One could say this whole thing is like really, really crazy.
Something definitely in the gene pool.
So here we have Thyestes, who has not exactly had the last word, but what's going to happen is that his only remaining son, it'll be his son's duty to take revenge or to bring justice, if you want to look at it as justice, on the heads of Atreus. The problem is that by the time he's grown up enough to do it, Atreus has died. Homer says that it was Aegisthus who plotted the death of Agamemnon and had to convince Clytemnestra to go along with him, and that he's the one that did the deed. And, of course, Aeschylus' version is totally different from that.
She's a woman who maneuvers like a man, and he's a lion that lacks a lion's heart.
That's right. And the family, the royal house of Mycenae are always depicted with the emblems of lions. There's even their famous lion gate. And so all these references to the lions have to do with the house of Atreus and King Atreus and his brother Thyestes and their descendants. You know, according to Aeschylus, when Aegisthus grows up, Atreus is already dead, and his two sons, Agamemnon and Menelaus, are the generation that he'd have to deal with. And these two brothers marry two sisters. So here's Agamemnon marrying Clytemnestra and Menelaus marrying the famous Helen. And that plays into the idea of the Trojan War coming up later, because both of them, you could make the argument, were unfortunate in their choice of wives, because Agamemnon marries a woman.
Well, the women were not altogether faithful,
that's right.
We say.
And they're both going to be betraying their husbands in at least one fashion, if not more than one fashion. So in the case of Menelaus, he thinks he's very lucky because he's got the most beautiful woman on the face of the earth. But supposedly all of the suitors for her hand had promised that whoever her father chose, that they would be his allies. So years later, when she either ran away with Prince Paris, there's hospitality again. Of course, Menelaus not only gets his troops revved up to go and get his wife back and to teach those foreigners a lesson for doing that to the civilized Greeks, but he also is going to call up all of his allies, including his brother. But in the meantime, see, here's Agamemnon, who's gathered his ships, and all of these other kings of city-states gathering their ships and men, and they collected at a place called Aulis and are getting ready to sail to this Battle of Troy. And
I'd like actually to take over here and look at the sea.
Okay.
The Chorus talks about this event where in which Agamemnon and his troops are stranded at the port of Aulis, because Artemis, protectress of Troy and the one who protects women in childbirth, favors the Trojans. And she's upset that these two sons of Atreus mean to go over and destroy her pet city. So she tells Agamemnon through a prophet, Calchas, that the only way she'll allow him favorable winds to sail to Troy is if he'll kill his own daughter, Iphigenia. By the way, sacrifice, in a sense, is like feeding your child to the gods all over again, is it not? Rather ironic that Artemis would ask for that, because the gods were offended, as we saw earlier, when Pelops was served to them. And the Chorus definitely underscores this irony that he will avenge a woman's loss by sacrificing another woman.
And, the versions of the legend that I'm familiar with, how does he send for his daughter to the army camp and have her sacrificed?
He tells without, her she's going
so
to
supposedly
marry.
He tells her mother, Clytemnestra, that he's arranged a marriage with her and Achilles, the famous hero. And so she comes expecting to be a bride and mother, and she were thinking that this was a happy occasion, that she was going willingly to marry rather than to be sacrificed. And so imagine the wrath of the mother, Clytemnestra, then, when she learns that she's been duped in such a fashion, that she's been betrayed and lied to by her husband.
And it certainly gives new meaning when it's hoist her over the altar. It gives new meaning to that idea of the altar where one marries.
Right.
Not. Though, of course, that's more...
Instead of the altar, you know, of life and a future, she has the altar of where she's the sacrificial victim. And, of course, immediately the winds begin to blow, and the troops sail off to Troy, and ultimately, 10 years later, to victory. So when he's coming home, he's bringing home lots of honor to the city, as well as to his family, as being the one of the commanders-in-chief of the great Greek forces who've destroyed the enemy, the Trojans. He comes home with not only great honor to his people and to the Greeks as a whole, but also with a war prize of a young princess, the Princess Cassandra, who was a priestess of Apollo's. And supposedly, according to the legends about her, she's an unfortunate victim of the gods' interference in people's lives, shall we say, because apparently the god Apollo was interested in having her as one of his lovers. And she at first seemed to, you might say, Lady Mona, seemed to say yes, but then at the ninth hour decides to say no and angers the god Apollo. As a priestess of Apollo, he'd given her the gift of sight, of seeing the future. The problem is, when she refuses him, he decides that he's going to add a little twist to this gift, and that is that she would indeed see the future and see true, but no one would be able to believe her, or no one would understand her prophecies. And, of course, prophets were always notoriously speaking in riddles and symbols and things of that sort anyway. But here she is, no matter how plainly she speaks, as we see in the first play of Aeschylus' trilogy, even if she were to flat out say, you know, Clytemnestra is going to kill Agamemnon, there's this curse, which is between her speech and their ears, something happens. They understand she's suffering. They understand she's crying out to Apollo. They understand she's upset and that she's saying something bad's going to happen. But they don't comprehend that she's actually telling them that the queen is getting ready to murder not just her husband, Agamemnon, as part of supposedly the celebration. So here we have again, you know, a celebration that's planned for the returning troops and the king. And so when the queen comes out and gives him this kind of over-the-top reception, welcoming him home as if, you know, she couldn't wait for him to come home, her beloved husband. And, of course, everything she says has this kind of double entendre, you know.
Oh, yes. And
invites him to walk on these purple tapestries or red tapestries into the house, which he feels is not the proper way. She's like greeting him as a god, not as a human being. But yet he allows her to talk him into doing it. He goes into the house, and she's got this specially prepared bath, ritual cleansing, you know, before the banquet. But she's intending to have her own little special ritual cleansing by blood of killing him. And she thinks of herself as being entitled to do that. It's just another, I mean, she's the kind of woman who says, you know, that the death of these two just makes her, you know, her marriage bed with Aegisthus and the enjoyments that she has there stronger. Well, I mean, she's not your ordinary Greek wife about to accept this, if I could use the pun, lying down. She's just not about to do that, you know, without getting her own back.
But of course, the irony is she's having an affair.
Oh, I know it
herself.
Is. But I think she would think that...
Is she protecting herself and Aegisthus?
That's it. I think that although she says, and Aegisthus too, says things like, well, what they're doing is strictly bringing justice, Aegisthus says, for the deaths of his brothers and the madness of his father, and here's Clytemnestra saying she's only bringing justice for the death of her innocent child, Iphigenia. But what really muddies the waters here is that both of them have something to gain, because she's having this affair with her husband's enemy, Aegisthus, and Aegisthus is going to marry her, and the two of them will rule the kingdom that used to be ruled by her husband. So they have something to gain here, and so they can say all they want about how they're instruments of the god's justice and proud of what they do, and face down the chorus and remind the chorus that the king had done some things that weren't right. And so why judge them so harshly when the chorus hadn't judged her husband, Agamemnon, equally harshly for sacrificing his daughter? But on the other hand, their motives are not really that pure at all.
Well,
there's the motives they admit
to.
This
is the idea of double motivation.
Yeah,
explained to me that essentially they're doing the right thing, but partly for the wrong reasons.
That's it. And also, there's the, like I said, the I always like to say that there's the motivation that you admit to, and then there's the motivation that you perhaps even hide from yourself to make yourself seem more worthy somehow. It seems like Aegisthus is taking a page from his father's book, while Agamemnon is off fighting a war, rather than Aegisthus taking on Agamemnon man-to-man. He works through the king's marriage bed. He goes behind the king's back and gets in cahoots with Clytemnestra to bring down the king, to get his justice, if you will. And in fact, according to Aeschylus' version, doesn't do the deed. Now, I do think that makes more sense to me, personally, because if Clytemnestra, who's no blood kin to Agamemnon, is the one that actually hacks him to death, then the Furies are not likely to descend upon her. He had her come for a wedding. She has him preparing for a banquet in his honor to celebrate his victory, and so he's not likely to be suspecting that she would do such a thing.
Well,
whereas if Aegisthus had walked into the bath, you know, immediately the king, who's a warrior, you know, would be on the defensive. And if Aegisthus managed to kill his first cousin, then he would wind up perhaps being at risk, whereas she would not.
Well, I think another thing that's going on is that Clytemnestra's killing Agamemnon is utmost disgrace.
Right.
For a man to be killed,
especially
by the sword and by a woman.
Right. His own sword or his own battle axe, as the depictions on the vase painting show. But
yeah.
That's to die in bed of old age was probably the only thing worse than being killed by a woman. But, I mean, there goes his fame. There goes his future recognition in the eyes of Greeks, that he's not as one of the principal destroyers of Troy, one of the victors, but he dies ignominiously at the hands of his wife.
Indeed, in the Odyssey, that's how we see him, representing his story. It's kind of interesting here. He says, very ironically, I have a sense of right and wrong. What's more, heaven's proudest gift, call no man blessed until he ends his life in peace, fulfilled. Thinking, of course, that he's coming home a war hero and that he'll end his life in peace, fulfilled, but the audience already knows.
He's already done his great deeds to be,
honored. That he is walking to his death, even as he says.
Right.
This.
Right.
Lest he isn't.
But of course, you know, when he walks into the bath, she has very little time to talk Cassandra into coming in there because she plans to kill her as well. And she can't stand out there arguing all the time with Cassandra to come in the house. And Cassandra seems to be in the grip of some kind of vision and isn't coming in. And so it leaves the chorus to have this extended scene with Cassandra. And Cassandra trying her best to get them to understand her. And finally giving up and deciding, well, you know, this is her fate. I mean, she's tired of life anyway. She's lost home and freedom and kith and kin and... Why continue with a life with the god Apollo punishing her this way, where she tells people the truth and no one heeds her or understands her? So she, by herself, walks down from that chariot, walks in those doors, knowing that what awaits her, that she is one of the sacrifices on the altar of justice, according to his wife, Clytemnestra, who will then turn the battle axe or the sword upon her. And so we have the last scene in the first play of the trilogy with Clytemnestra first, and later Aegisthus coming out and standing over the bodies of the slain priestess Cassandra and King Agamemnon, and bragging about the fact. And it reminds me of what you said in that line a while ago with King Agamemnon, when he said, let all be well, or something to that effect, when he's stepping on those tapestries because he knows that's probably not a wise thing to do, but he's doing it anyway. At the end, it reminds me of Clytemnestra's speech at the end, where she's basically saying to the chorus, after arguing with them for a time and presenting her side of the case, and then Aegisthus comes out and tries to kind of intimidate them, and she calls a halt to that too. So you can see who wears the pants in that relationship, and basically says, you know, that she feels like what's been done here today is justice, and then let everything be, let's everybody cool down and let all be well, you know. So you wind up having this really intricate interweaving of evils and of people thinking that they're justified in what they're doing. Of course, what she is not taking into consideration, she and Aegisthus both, at the end of this play, when they think, well, okay, we'll work this out, we're in power now, we're going to set the house to rights, is that, remember, Cassandra, before she went in to her death, had said to the chorus, to remember what I say to you now,
somebody
that when a man dies for a man and a woman for a woman, then she will have justice for her murder, and Agamemnon will have justice for his. So, again, we have this idea that it's going to be laying this burden on the next generation, and it does. Because this young man that she's talking about is the son of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra. Or maybe they have plans for him so that he'll never reach his majority. But if Orestes, the son of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, does reach adulthood, then it will be his duty, his responsibility, to seek justice for the murder of his father. And that would mean having to kill two blood relatives, his mother, you know, and matricide is thought to be a horrible thing, and Aegisthus, who's a cousin, right? So if anybody's going to wind up having to be at risk for the wrath of the Furies, those ancient beings who seem to exist for that kind of thing, then it'll be poor old Orestes. And Orestes seems to be smart, like his mother, in the fact that he worries about what is the right thing to do in this situation. So we have the second play, The Libation Bearers by Aeschylus, and the final play, The Eumenides, The Kindly Ones, where that gets worked out about whether it's the right thing for him to do, whether he should do it, whether he has to do it. And, of course, like we said earlier, he consults the Oracle of Delphi, the priestess of Apollo, and is told by Apollo that he must do what's right, and that is to avenge or to bring justice upon those who killed his father, meaning he has to kill his mother as well as her second husband, his cousin, Aegisthus. But then the Furies do descend upon him. So he winds up suffering, even though he obeys the gods again.
But part of what's being worked out here, and we have to remember, Aeschylus, it appears that he very, very consciously was stacking the cards against matriarchy. Okay, the Furies are daughters of Mother Night, mm-hmm. whereas the Olympians, you know, have Father Cronus, Father Time, mm-hmm. and Father Zeus mm-hmm. is their king and head. So we're transitioning from a matriarchal, you know, past, which was irrational, mm-hmm. where people could be double-binded mm-hmm. or double-bound, to a patriarchal future where Zeus and the Olympians ensure that things will be fair and rational. We have a very masculine woman who is to be killed, and then her son will be vindicated.